testing. Please be seated for the next event. Please be seated for the next event. Hi, everybody. My name's Emily Atkin. I'm the editor-in-chief of Heated. And I'm so excited to be emceeing this next round of lightning talks, which is essentially what I like to think of as stories that I wish that I wrote talk and how to write them in the future. Heated is a two-person newsroom, but we do have a Slack channel. We do have a Slack, and in that Slack, there are multiple channels, and one of those channels is called I Wish I Wrote That. And I think every single story in this round of talks has probably been in the I Wish I Wrote That Slack channel. So just a quick thing about how this is going to work. The lightning talks are 5 to 7 minutes. We will try our best to get through those as quickly as possible. Speakers, you'll go up here, and then there will be little cue cards for your time remaining. There will also be slides. We will do questions at the end. So if you want to ask a reporter about their story, and it's one of like the first couple of reporters, just make sure to like write it down so you don't forget, because we're going to go through all of them before we open it up to questions. So let's just get the show on the road, try to get through it. It's the lightning talk. So the first story is going to be from this really great publication. It's called Heated. And it will be presented by Heated Enterprise reporter Ariel Samuelson. Right up here.
Hi. Nope. That's where the mic is. Hello. Yes. Okay. So I'm going to start by saying that I have never spoken at a journalism conference before, so I'm sorry if I'm nervous. I usually talk about other people's work. Today I'm going to try to talk about my own, so here we go.
Thank you so much.
So as Emily said, I'm a reporter at Heated. If you don't know us, we are a climate accountability newsletter. It was started by Emily, and she hired me last year. And last year, in December, we got an exciting opportunity. We co-published a story with The Guardian. So you can see here, it was published on both Heated on the left and The Guardian on the right. And this story is about the propane industry and how they have spent tens of millions of dollars to try to convince the public that propane is a green, clean energy alternative that will usher us into a new clean energy future. So here are the ads that these tens of millions of dollars have paid for. They have done everything from pay social media influencers. They have also run ads like the top left, which is the introduction to an ad that tells you that school buses would be cleaner if they ran on propane. Rebecca, who will speak after me, wrote an amazing story about that. But the beginning of the story starts with the ad in the lower left corner. You can see these beautiful fields of what looks like wheat. And this is an ad that was in the New York Times. It was actually in the middle of an article about eco-anxiety, so if you are nervous about the climate crisis, don't worry, this field of wheat will save you. So we had a reader send a screenshot of this to us, and the reader said, you know, do you know anything about this? What is this? So I started looking into it, and the group behind it is called the Propane Education and Research Council. They are a federal checkoff program, so they are funded by the propane that's sold within the United States. They make a fee, and that passes through the government. They are not allowed to lobby, so all of these ads are education. So once I started looking into PERC, I reached out to the Energy and Policy Institute. If you haven't heard their name pop up already, you will throughout these talks. They are wonderful as a resource. And Charlie Spatz, when I asked him about these ads, goes, "Do I have some recordings for you?" So That was how the story progressed. This is the impetus of the story right here. This is from a recording of a public meeting. Every year, PERC has public meetings that until Charlie started going, no one showed up to except the oil and gas industry. But they spoke freely about their plans, about how to market propane. And this quote right here that's highlighted is PERC's vice president of communications saying, "We don't want people to see us as dirty energy like coal. We want them to see us as clean energy. And we should pull that tactic from the natural gas industry playbook." So they actually say that on the record. So they then spent nearly $30 million over 2 years to advertise themselves as clean energy. The way we found out how much they spent is we worked with Amy and drilled, and we were able to get into the nitty-gritty of how much they paid each media outlet to run these ads. So that sounds like a great story, easy smoking gun. Absolutely not. The story may look good once it's published, but it was terrible to write. I'm sure all of you have had that story. And here's why. Because PERC is not new to this rodeo. They have been around for decades. And their strategy was not to sell propane as renewable energy, because propane is a fossil fuel. Their strategy was to sell renewable propane, which is a separate fuel made from things like cooking oil, and then use the same words to sell fossil fuel propane and run those ads at the same time in the same kinds of publications and hope that people thought all propane was clean energy. This makes the story very complicated for a reader, because you have to explain renewable propane, what is that propane, and then you have to sort of prove that PERC knew what they were doing when they were advertising renewable propane, and its purpose was to greenwash propane. So thankfully, I have Emily as an editor, and we also had Danielle Renwick at The Guardian, and we also had our secret weapon, which is Charlie, who knows the ins and outs of this industry. And what we decided to do is we sort of decided to break this story up into two chunks. So we started with the marketing that PERC used to advertise fossil fuel propane. And the way that we were able to get that information is through FOIA requests that EPI had done. So they had their internal presentations where they laid out, this is how we should market fossil fuel propane. We also had training videos from them where they trained members of their staff on how to talk to people about propane. And we also had these recordings in which they said, we did surveys of millennials and Gen Zers who are going to buy homes that will be powered by propane. And they care about the environment. So we care about the environment. 2 minutes. Okay, I'm going to talk fast. And then in the second half, we decided, because they're selling renewable propane as a legitimate future, we have to dig into renewable propane and find out if it's the real deal. So we talked to clean energy experts. I also interviewed greenwashing experts. And through those interviews, we were able to show that renewable propane, there is 0.04%. That's how much renewable propane is in the United States compared to the amount of propane that is sold. I'm distracted by the 1 minute. Hold on. Okay. So that was how we sort of, we laid out the story in a way that we hoped would lead the reader from, this is how the industry is greenwashing propane. And as for impact, the thing that mattered the most is I was actually able to get Aaron Hatcher, the vice president of communications at PERC, on the phone. And after our interview, in which I asked her a lot of really detailed questions about renewable propane, she went and changed the website to say that the EPI had not approved any of their statements. That was my favorite impact. And then after our story ran, they wrote a response in which they said that we were spreading misinformation, as opposed to owning the fact that they were full of misinformation. So that also was part of the impact. And the last 30 seconds are the most important. We end every heated newsletter with one of our readers' pets. So this was General Tafferson, a.k.a. Taffy, was the cat who who ended this story. That's all. Thank you so much.
That's right. amazing story. So good. No bias here. thank you very much, Arielle. It was a great presentation. Thank you for kicking us off. Our next presenter is Rebecca Lieber, who wrote about how the fossil fuel industry convinced Americans to love gas stoves. Let's hear it for Rebecca.
Okay, thank you. Pulling up. So I'm going to talk about a story I did in 2021 at Mother Jones, so a couple years ago. So how the fossil fuel industry convinced Americans to love gas stoves. This was a story that looked at the health research around emissions from stoves that's existed for decades, but has been picking up steam the last few years in mounting evidence. But also joining that with misinformation campaigns and also the marketing from the fossil fuel industry, how it's used the gas stove as a tool against climate and electrification fights. So I thought I would begin with what drew me to this story in the first place. Like, how did I come across this? And it's funny because Charlie Spatz also gets a shout out here. brilliant researcher at Energy and Policy Institute. I was talking to him one day about gas stove influencers, which instantly caught my attention. So these are just some screenshots. These are still there. If you go on the hashtag cooking with gas, you see influencers posing with spatulas. The one on the left there is a natural gas fireplace. And this raised an instant obvious question for me, which was pretty narrow, which was, why would the gas industry, so these were sponsored by a gas trade group, why would the gas industry bother to hire influencers? Why was it doing this? And that motive wasn't totally straightforward, because gas stoves itself are pretty small change when it comes to the industry's balance sheet. So there had to be something else going on. What was going on were electrification campaigns, cities around the country that were considering building codes to boost energy efficiency and cleaner technologies. So one of the manifestations of this was in Culver City, California. So part of the story connected the dots to this campaign in Culver City where they were considering these reforms. And this is a website from a gas coalition, Californians for Balanced Energy Solutions. So what you see here is a screenshot from their website, and these big blocks of text are anonymous next door comments that they had posted on their website that were opposing any action that Culver City might take. So what I was able to confirm is that this middle one was posted by a PR representative on Nextdoor, posing as a community member, and it got some traction on Nextdoor. I wasn't able to find these other two, but couldn't also figure out the attribution. So that was confirmed that this was a PR industry hired by this group that was behind this. So what I had at this point was a few interesting leads and reporting string around something weird going on around gas stoves. So I knew at this point that the gas stove was valuable to the industry, but also it was actively leveraging it in these electrification fights. There was more to this story, and this is where I had a challenge in trying to connect the dots to a lot of disparate evidence. And one of my more fundamental questions here was, who was responsible for making gas stoves so popular? Why was this such a valuable tool for the industry? Going a level deeper. And for this, looking at archival evidence was really helpful. So these are just a few examples. This kind of stuff goes back a century. The phrase cooking with gas was an industry invention. I'll just point out, these are all from like 60s to 80s, but the one on the left is a Rap lyrics There's a great YouTube clip of actual video of them performing this in very like 80s outfits. I highly recommend it. It's always fun. This historical research really started helping me connect these dots, that there was this longer narrative arc to tell. A lot of it was coming from the American Gas Association. So connecting that back, though, to today, that was the trick here. And here I have some quotes that were in the story from a gas industry executive. And these were these helped kind of connect why this wasn't just an interesting, isolated bit of history. But the industry saw this as an important tool for its fights today. So here was the top quote is the executive talking about how they were monitoring the scientific data coming out, but she here arguing that to charge ahead. And then the second quote was even more fun because she was actually reacting internally to my own reporting. And that, again, thanks to Charlie Spatz for getting that in a in a public records request. So it's always fun to see someone react to your own reporting. Just to close out on the impact of this work, so the story continues. This was from a few years ago. Since some of my work has been cited in the Consumer Product Safety Commission's inquiry into gas stoves, it's been played an important role in these local fights around electrification and combating misinformation. This closing out is a screenshot from a more recent story I did this fall on Julia Child in the gas industry. And this was about how Hollywood, how the gas industry, so specifically American Gas Association, has had its influences in Hollywood and TV as well. This example was it sponsored one of Julia Child's shows. And again, it's always important to connect that history to today that it sponsored this decades ago, but in recent comments to Department of Energy on its consideration of efficiency standards, they cited Julia Child's love of the gas stove as reason that they should not move ahead with efficiency standards. That same comment, of course, doesn't mention their own role in this sponsorship. So, I will leave it there. And the story isn't over yet.
Thank you, Rebecca. I think both of these last two stories are really interesting examples of how industries can use advertising, sponsorships, influencers, essentially propaganda for a larger policy objective. They don't just exist on their own. And part of our jobs as reporters is to dig into that and find what that is. And I think the next story is a really good example of that. The next story is from Maxine Joslow at the Washington Post, talking about her story, how dark money groups led Ohio to define gas as green energy.
Hi, everyone. I'm a little taller, so I'm just going to move this. Can everyone hear me like that? Okay. Hi, so I'm talking about my story about a bill that passed in Ohio last year that legally redefined natural gas as a source of, quote, green energy. So here you see a gas-fired power plant in Ohio. That is legally in the state of Ohio a source of, quote, green energy, even though we've spent a lot of time today talking about how methane is the primary component of natural gas. Some argue it should be called methane gas. In Ohio, it's now called green energy. I was curious why that was, how that bill came about, and a common refrain from the last two speakers is that the Energy and Policy Institute helped them. They also helped me. It was not Charlie Spatz. It was his colleague, Dave Anderson. But obviously, they're a great resource, and people should take advantage of them. So they helped file a state public records request on communications among
the Ohio Republican lawmakers who authored this bill. And what those communications showed is that this bill didn't come out of nowhere. It came from close coordination with two dark money groups with ties to the gas industry. So the first group was called the Empowerment Alliance. And one of the emails showed that, let me back up. So the Empowerment Alliance is a group that advocates for natural gas or methane gas. It's run by a guy named Tom Raston. He is listed in Federal Election Commission filings as an executive at the Ariel Corporation, which is a manufacturer of gas compressors. He and his wife also spent $1 million from the Empowerment Alliance on electing Ohio Republican lawmakers in the previous election cycle, and the two of them are major Republican donors who have dined with former President Trump and donated heavily to conservative causes. And what these emails showed is that Tom Raston wrote to Ohio State Republican senators saying, quote, "We are on the right track with natural gas is green energy." So here we clearly saw coordination with that group. That was not the only group that they were coordinating with. The second group was called ALEC. A lot of you may be familiar with them. It stands for the American Legislative Exchange Council. Their whole shtick is drafting model bills that they ideally hope conservative lawmakers will take back to their states, introduce in their state house, and ultimately get passed into law in states around the country. And what these emails showed is that one of the state Republican lawmakers wrote and said, quote, "I will be leaving the ALEC convention with some model legislation to define that natural gas is clean energy." So here we have these two groups involved in this bill. A big challenge in reporting this story and after the story was published is that ALEC did not go quietly into the night. They did not respond to my request for comment when I reached out to them for the story over the course of my reporting. But once the story was published, they reached out and took strong issue with the way that it characterized ALEC's involvement. They argued that this bill was never actually adopted by their Energy and Environment Task Force. Therefore, it was not official ALEC policy. Therefore, it's incorrect to say that they were involved. We updated the story to reflect that information, but otherwise, we stood by the story completely, and we felt that this line makes pretty clear their involvement. What was the impact? So MSNBC actually ran a segment on the story, helped it get out to a lot more eyes than just people who pick up a copy of the Washington Post or read the Post online. And I'm just going to play, can I play like a short clip of this? Okay. Okay, maybe not. Yeah, that's it though. I kept mine really short. So.
Thank you. Well, all three of these last stories have been, you know, focused on U.S. sort of gas and propane industry based in the U.S., but as we all know, climate change is a much larger problem than just fossil fuels. There are a lot of other industries contributing to it, and then there are a lot of other countries involved, not just the U.S. So I think this is this next story touches on two more of those things. Jenny Splitter is coming up, the editor-in-chief of Sentient Media, talking about the Dublin Declaration is riddled with animal industry bias.
So hi, I'm Jenny. I'm editor-in-chief of Sentient. We're a small nonprofit news outlet. We cover industrial animal ag and its impact on pretty much everything. Food system, health, climate, environment, policy, you know, you name it, we try to cover. But we are quite small, and so I mentioned this just to say that this presentation is a bit different because I'm basically including coverage from a few different places on the Dublin Declaration. And I think I was thinking of Amy's words of, like, you need to have this, sometimes a story covered multiple times to get the word out. And I think this is a good example. So before we covered it, what happened starts in Dublin. you know, in the fall of 2022. And basically, the Irish, you know, version of the USDA. I'm so American. Sorry. I don't even know how to start that. But anyway, they host this summit on the societal role of meat. And at this summit, they sort of launched this idea of the Dublin Declaration, which is like this manifesto of meat's importance in society and kind of defense of meat. And one of the people there is Frederick Leroy. And I mentioned him because he's almost a European counterpart to Frank Mitlohner, except he's way less disciplined. Like, there's like five blog posts ranting about me and various other journalists. Like, he's a different character, but one to look out for. So they launched this declaration. They're going to get like 1,000 scientists to sign it. TBD on who these scientists are. I mean, not TBD, but to come, sorry. But anyway, they, you know, and they also say they're going to like, they also decide they're going to try to publish it in this, in a journal. Okay. And so then once it gets published in this journal, which I will tell you about, it got a certain kind of coverage. And this was kind of it. They did use this like zealots pushing plant-based diets kind of language. And I wrote down some of the key things that were basically in it, because it is kind of more like manifesto-y, not really like science-y. So, you know, that meat's like that provides essential ingredients, livestock's natural, livestock provides jobs, you know, basically factual things. The other point that they kind of make is that, like, sure, wealthy people can maybe get by without meat, but, you know, most people need meat. And I guess I was thinking, like, you know, could be technically true, but just to point out that there's obviously like a lot of cultures that eat largely plant-based. And so it's, you know, it's a certain framing, right, that they're presenting. And here's some more of these, of this coverage. So we noticed this. Two of our writers actually noticed this. And so we ended up covering it. Grace is our staff writer, and there's also another person who helped with the reporting named Caroline Christian, who did this whole like spreadsheet going through all of the signatories. And before I get to sort of that breakdown, they published the paper in this Animal Frontiers journal. And one of, you know, our reporting just kind of showed that basically this is something where, you know, you can't, it's not sort of your normal peer reviewed journal. It's, you know, led by industry organizations. And also you have to be, you know, they don't accept, you know, unsolicited submissions. You have to be invited to publish. They also published it as a letter in Nature Food, but that's, you know, not peer reviewed, just to kind of make that clear. So we reported on it, included all this, and also had this like spreadsheet and some graphs on who the signatories are. And so, you know, 60% had affiliations with the meat industry. pie chart. And then also, like, one thing we wanted to point out is that even though they are sort of, like, making this suggestion, which you see come up again and again from the meat industry, that, like, you know, people need, you know, protein and, like, people, you know, we don't want to be depriving people of meat, the sort of research shows that actually it's the global north that largely needs to reduce its meat consumption. And so they're making this argument, yet most of the signatories were actually located in global north countries. And then Food Unfolded, which is another great small outlet, did a further breakdown, found, you know, similar things, and also that 30% did not have, you know, relevant backgrounds in environmental science or human health science. And then this is just a PR org that was involved and comes out later in this, like, Guardian story about this. And just so to kind of put it out there, basically, like, Red Flag is this PR group that does a lot of work for meat industry, pesticide companies, that kind of thing. And you know, they often will do something like partner with dietitians to have them. They do a lot of partnering with influencers also to get their messages out. So they were also kind of part of this. And I wanted to put in this tweet because I guess I think it's just a good example of kind of the thing that sort of like some of the academics who are very aligned with industry will do. They won't necessarily themselves tweet the most egregious things, but often they'll retweet something like this, which we can argue about cultivated meat, but it's just it's usually just like, you know, not nuanced, let's just say. And this is part of, so in addition to the Unfolded coverage and our coverage, Zach Boren at Unearthed, who also was part of the bigger investigation that led to this New York Times piece on Frank Mitloner that you may have seen. I think that was a year ago or something. He also then did this investigative work into the signatories of the Dublin Declaration. And this is just kind of like another example of one of the authors of this, you know, even though it was kind of picked up by New York Post and these other outlets as like scientists say this, you know, this is really like an industry person, you know, McKinsey consultant and who's like really part of agribusiness, not like an independent scientist. And I think, those are all the people who are part of it. Not sure how many minutes left I have. Thank you.
One of the most cited reporters on my personal, I wish I wrote that Slack channel, is Darna Noor from The Guardian. she's coming up here, and she's the next story is U.S. utility firms offer builders cash and trips to fit new homes with gas appliances.
Hi, everyone. I am taking us back to the theme of the oil industry and the gas industry with this one. The story was for The Guardian, again, where I'm the fossil fuels and climate reporter, and it was called U.S. Utilities Offer Builders Cash and Trips to Fit New Homes with Gas Appliances. So a lot of that is what it says on the tin, but I'll tell you how we got there. I actually want to start back, you know, several years ago. 5 years ago, at the time I was working at Gizmodo's recently deceased climate vertical earther, and I think basically everyone else on this beat was really interested at the time in a new trend that was happening in cities and states across the nation, wherein there were efforts basically to ban or limit the use of gas in new homes. So until then, we'd seen a lot of focus, right, on trying to limit the use of fossil fuels at the point of extraction, at the point of distribution through pipelines and things like this. This was a really big sort of new focus. I mean, not brand new, but there was a big focus, I think, in our reporting at the time on the efforts to limit the use of gas in the home itself. So limit the use of gas appliances, gas pipes in homes and restaurants and things like this. And there were some pretty big wins at the time. But then something weird started to happen, which is that governments basically started introducing these policies to preempt these bans. So ban the bans. And in some cases, before they were even a thought in the brains of any policymakers in that place. And I want to shout out Ben Storo, who was at E&E News. And he uncovered at the time, again, with help from the Energy and Policy Institute, a running theme here. He found that there were emails that linked these efforts to this group called the Energy Solutions Center, which I just always kind of stuck with me that, that there was this group called the Energy Solutions Center. They happened to share an address with the American Gas Association, which is the, you know, kind of best known, I think, gas lobbying trade group, rather, in this country. So just always kind of stuck with me. Then last year, EPI came to me with something interesting that they'd found, which is that utilities were starting to actually incentivize builders to put gas appliances in homes. And in some cases, in places where there was starting to be some talk of introducing these moves to limit the use of gas in homes. So here's just one example. This is from the Rocky Mountain Institute, or the Rocky Mountain Energy Resources in North Carolina, a gas utility. They offer incentives for builders who install gas-powered water heaters and furnaces and clothes dryers and cooking ranges in homes. And then here's another really wild one. This is a program in which CenterPoint Energy in Minnesota, that's a massive utility, participates in. And through this program, builders can accrue points for every home they outfit with gas appliances. And when they accrue those points, they can use them to trade in for things like paid vacations and sports tickets and getting wined and dined in Punta Cana. And I found, actually, that public officials in Minnesota were actually paying some attention to this. And, in fact, you know, early last year had been calling on the utility to stop its use of these kinds of incentives programs. So clear to me that in some ways there was interest in getting rid of these incentives, to say the least. I became kind of obsessed with this for a few months. I started obsessively looking around, and I found some more of these incentive programs. Here's one offered by Washington Gas, which operates in my home state of Maryland. And again, I remembered Ben Storrow's work from years ago, uncovering those emails from Energy Solutions Center. And I wanted to see if they might be involved in this whole thing in any way. So I connected with some sources with some deep industry information, started poking around on some folks who had some connections with Energy Solutions Center, talked to people who had attended conferences they've been to, and someone came through and was able to actually leak me some information showing that gas utilities were also training representatives of utilities to encourage builders and realtors to push the continued use of gas in homes. So this is from an industry presentation from 2018, just kind of explicitly saying that homes built with natural gas sell for more money than electric homes, aka if you're a realtor, you can make more money on them. I also heard audio from several sessions from 2018 and later. One of my favorite quotes was when a facilitator said, what you have to stress to realtors is all the fun things. Remind them all the fun things that they and their clients can have with natural gas, rattling off things like a beautiful gas fireplace, for instance, and of course not mentioning that there are you know, fully electric versions of all of those appliances. But of course not relevant to the builders, not relevant to the realtors, even though in many cases those are the most trusted professionals in the sort of home buying experience. This was a lot of information. At this point, I had spent, you know, months digging into this stuff. I had uncovered a bunch of different examples. I had the sort of historic evidence from, you know, from recent years. And I sort of was losing the plot a little bit. And I was like, I know that I want to say something about the role that, home builders have in this whole, effort to limit electrification. But unsurprisingly, a lot of the utilities were not really talking to me very much, or they would say to just talk to their trade group, the American Gas Association. You know, a lot of builders were really disinterested in speaking to me. They would say that it was normal. And I started to think, okay, well, maybe it's totally normal actually for, gas to be incentivized, even though we know that it, you know, has been linked to childhood asthma and various kinds of cancer and things like this. So I think like many others who have spoken before me, found real help in digging through the archives. Here is a page from an issue of the American Gas Association's publication from 1979 showing celebrity chef Jacques Pepin at the American Gas Association booth at a home builder's show. Many of the industry recordings that I had heard, again, were at home builder shows. Really not a whole lot of difference in the sort of effect that it seems that they were going for, convincing realtors to keep gas in the homes with, you know, various kind of lovely perks like, you know, a paid vacation or getting to meet a celebrity. This really helped me put it all together. Here's another page that we found from another issue of AGA Monthly from 1964 that essentially outlined a plan by gas utilities to ensure that new developments would opt for gas over electricity in consultation with home builders. And I realized that this wasn't just a story about some disparate utility programs. It was really a story about the untold role that builders had had in, you know, fighting off electrification efforts and in keeping gas in the home for decades, it seemed. So I, you know, I initially thought, I think, that this was going to be some kind of long, flowy story with all sorts of beautiful anecdotes from home builders. That didn't end up happening. Home builders don't really want to talk about the fact that they're, you know, accepting all this kinds of money. But instead, we ended up writing a sort of explainer that went through the various sort of ways over the years that home builders and gas associations had been working together. I, like Emily, was very excited to see that the Energy Solutions Center sort of changed some information on their websites. And I wanted to share this in part with you today because I know there are lots of local reporters in the room. So maybe check out if your gas utility is offering an incentive program like this one.
Do So far, I'm like very struck by all of these stories kind of showing that this narrative that I feel like we've been fed from a long time that like we're just not passing climate policy or solving climate change because like Americans just don't want to, or like people just don't want to. It's like against human nature, right? It's all of these, what all these stories do is pull the curtain back a little bit and they show like actually it's not simply because of that. It's because industries have been spending a lot of money on certain tactics to ensure that that's the case, whether it's ads, whether it's, paying off builders, whether it's paying influencers. And then I think this next story is a really, really interesting way that industries influence policy is by pretending to be us. And so Miranda Green from Floodlight is going to talk about that.
Let's see, I am one of the shorter ones, so let's see how this works. Okay, let's go to this one. Okay, so I wanted to start with telling you guys about a series of reporting that I've been doing, not just a specific story, but the series would not have happened if it weren't for the first piece we did. And that story started with an old-fashioned Southern feud. And from that leaked thousands of records, and I am going to start with a video.
And that's for plausible deniability. And so you got to ask, well, what do they want to be able to plausibly deny? Matrix is a political consultancy based in Alabama, and you probably never heard of them. And that's okay, they like it that way. They work in the shadows, and some of its biggest customers have been electric power utilities, like Florida Power and Light. They would purchase advertising, they would send private investigators to look up dirt on people who may not necessarily have been doing stuff that their clients liked. They would get journalists to knock on the doors of politicians that had policies that their clients weren't fans of. It was a whole host of practices that many would consider incredibly questionable.
I was going to ask, I think we cut that.
Yeah, we may need to put it back in. I think we're still going to be able to prove all of this, very clearly. Matrix LLC was active in 10 states, at least. They had a multi-million dollar yearly business. They're still in operation today. And making sure that that industry doesn't get to work in the shadows is a lot of the work that Floodlight does as investigative journalists.
All right, great.
There's a reason why they hire.
Don't need to watch it again. There we go. Okay. Thanks. So that was my colleague Mario Ariza. He was with me on stage earlier. I think he's in the audience, or at least he was a little bit before. Last year, he and I spent 5 months reporting on a story that had all the hallmarks of a John Grisham novel. Bitter ex-business partners, wronged spouses, private investigators, accused of spying, even on reporters. But while the piece felt crazy on its face, it's also a tale as old as time. It was a story of money and power and greed.